Welcome. Today is Wednesday, November 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump continues to put together his White House team. Just who are the so-called white working class Americans who voted for Donald Trump?
He symbolized a middle finger up to Washington establishment.
Also ahead, marijuana, a big winner in last week's election, and a new and timely documentary on America's struggling criminal justice system. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, as U.S. President-elect Donald Trump works out who will be part of his administration, sources familiar with the situation say former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani is a leading candidate to be the country's next Secretary of State. Giuliani has experience as a federal prosecutor, but has no foreign policy experience, typical of those who've held the post in the past. But his choice of Steve Bannon as his top strategist is drawing criticism from rights groups on the Democratic and Republican side. In an open letter to Trump, a Democratic congressman wrote, "The appointment of Stephen Bannon, whose ties to the white nationalist movement have been well documented, directly undermines your ability to unite the country." VOA national correspondent Jim Malone gives International Edition's Ira Melman an idea of what is happening.
It seems as though what's one of the factors driving the possible selections here is loyalty to Donald Trump during the campaign. That's not unusual in our history that presidents want to appoint people they're comfortable with, though we should point out there was an excessive amount of vitriol within the Republican Party as Trump rose through the ranks. Are you with him, against him? And people who have associated with Trump from his business career note that he's very big on loyalty, and those who are seen as disloyal, generally aren't welcome in the inner circle. So let's see how this plays out. I mean, this is still informed speculation about who's going to be what. I noticed that another member of the transition team has left, a former Congressman Mike Rogers of Michigan, who has a lot of experience in the intelligence area, and some people had considered him a possibility for, intelligence chief. Whether that has to do with this loyalty thing to Trump, I don't know, but there seems to be some elements of sort of turmoil emanating from the transition at this point.
And just to open that up even a bit more, I mean, some of the reports have said that it's almost like hand fighting in that Trump organization.
Right. But I mean, look, he was an outsider and he took on the Republican establishment, never mind Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. And now the tone we're getting from the Republican congressional leaders is deferential to him. They all want to work together. We just heard a little while ago from House Speaker Paul Ryan. So the congressional wing seems to be mobilizing to carry out what Trump wants to do. They still have a ways to go, though, in sorting out who's going to be in the administration and the cabinet. And the names that will come forward will speak not only to Trump's desire to deliver on his promises to his base supporters, but what kind of tone will it set as he tries also to try to heal the country that even President Obama said yesterday was an important aspect of what he needs to do.
But you got to realize there are thousands of jobs that are up for grabs here. Is that correct?
Sure. And it's going to take a while. I mean, they're going to focus on the big ones first, and the rest will follow. But we've already seen with Reince Priebus coming in chief of staff, sort of a nod to the establishment. But Stephen Bannon, this controversial figure from Breitbart, as his key political counselor, that again shows that desire to maintain links with those who were most loyal to him during the campaign.
There have been reports that Donald Trump might be seeking some top security clearance for his eldest children. Any confirmation of that? And why would he want to do that anyway?
Well, I mean, again, he has relied on a small inner circle, and the children were a key part of that. I don't know where that goes. I don't know what the ethics questions that might be raised in connection with that. Not only that, what about the ethics questions raised in connection with his various business holdings?
Who the children, the very children, the reports say he wants high security clearance for, will be running that business.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're in uncharted territory to a degree, so how this plays out. Sometimes there are not hard and fast laws or rules about how some of this plays out, so it's going to take a while to sort it all out.
All right. Well, we will continue to follow that part of the story. But signs of a long and divisive presidential contest that nearly tore the Republican Party apart were nowhere to be seen on Capitol Hill on Tuesday. Republican members of the House of Representatives easily nominated Paul Ryan to be their leader.
This leadership team is unified. This entire House Republican conference is unified. And we are so eager to get to work with our new president-elect to fix America's pressing problems.
Well, in January, the new Congress will confirm him as Speaker for his first full term. But the elated post-election mood for Republicans on the Hill did show cracks as nearly 1,000 Washington, D.C. high school students marched to the Capitol protesting Donald Trump's election. President Barack Obama was in Greece Tuesday, bringing to Europe the much sought after assurances about the U.S. commitment to NATO under the presidency of Donald Trump. He's also talking about how he's going forward with the transition.
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that I was surprised by the election results, and I've said so. I still don't feel responsible for what the president-elect says or does, but I do feel a responsibility as president of the United States to make sure that I facilitate a good transition, and I present to him, as well as the American people, my best thinking, my best ideas about how you move the country forward.
Well, before leaving the White House, Athens is the first stop on Obama's last foreign trip as president.
On behalf of the American people, just let me say that we are proud to count Greece as one of our closest allies and one of our greatest friends.
And before leaving the White House Monday, President Obama said that Trump had expressed a great interest in maintaining America's core strategic relations. European leaders, alarmed by Trump's campaign statements on U.S. commitments, have been anxious for a clarification. Trump's campaign remarks have also fueled ongoing efforts to establish a European defense force separate from NATO. Well, the surprising election of Donald Trump has brought many questions here in the United States and abroad. It's widely viewed that a forgotten segment of the population, the so-called white working class, brought him the victory. Joining me now to talk about this, Dr. Justin Guest, professor of public policy at George Mason University and author of the book The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. Justin, thanks for being with us. Tell us about how you think this unlikely win came about in your view.
When I started my work on white working class politics about 5 years ago, it was very clear that this is a large group of people that is largely misunderstood and largely underestimated in terms of their electoral power, were someone or some party ever able to harness them. You know, I think that's been the problem up until now, is that political parties, mainstream political parties, have been reluctant to harness white working class people and make appeals to them because they're problematic for their coalition. For Democrats, white working class people put pressure on their desire to maintain strong blocks of minority voters with their social preferences. And for Republicans, their economic preferences for protectionism put pressure on Republicans, Wall Street moderates, and white suburbanites who don't like that kind of protectionism. So most of the, generally, the main political parties in the United States have steered clear or just gingerly approached white working class people without clearly and meaningfully appealing to them for their support. So then comes Donald Trump, who, after this 40 years of dismissal and tepid receptions from mainstream political parties, and he makes a deliberate appeal, a deliberate push for white working class voters. And he does so in the kind of messianic way that really reflects the desperation, the exasperation amongst many of these people in terms of their of political power and or loss of political power. And that sets him up to be king. And you go back to his speech during the Republican National Convention when he said, I am your voice. That is as messianic as it gets.
He also said he alone could fix this.
That's right. And that spoke and that resonated to white working class people who have felt underrepresented for a very long period of time.
What's interesting is that it always used to be that the Democratic Party was the party that the working class citizens looked to for help and compassion. What happened?
A number of things happened. First, during the glory days of white working class politics, the white working class represented not only a political backbone, but also an economic backbone. The manufacturing jobs that they had in the mid-20th century were paid well, they were stable, and that kind of stability and prosperity builds a really nice political base and coalition. As the manufacturing economy declined, so did white working class power, and also so did white working class numbers, thanks to demographic change and fertility rates. This became an increasingly smaller, less and less powerful group of people, and a less and less organized group of people because the unions declined with them. In many ways, the Democrats and their white working class backers began to diverge. If you look at the issues that Donald Trump hung his hat on, social policy, about anxiety about demographic change and xenophobia, and then from an economic perspective, anxiety about a globally integrated economy and trade protectionism. The Democrats have moved significantly further away from these views over time. They are now the party of minority groups and minority rights and of the protection of immigration in this country. And they are no longer espousing their protectionist views on trade that used to characterize the Democratic Party before 1992.
This whole movement that seems to be happening, we've got a huge uptick in hate crimes, even just in the last week since the election. How does this play into all of this?
First off, I think it's important that we understand that a vote for Donald Trump is not necessarily a vote or an endorsement of his policy platform, as vague as it was. So there are three reasons why someone would vote for Donald Trump. One is indeed agreement from a policy perspective. And there's no doubt a fraction of his supporters and his voters who really did believe in the change that he was going to bring or proposed to bring. But the second group of people were people who supported him because they simply could not stand his opponent. And so it was, as much as there's a Never Trump group inside the United States, there was a Never Hillary group as well. But the final group, and the group that I think makes up a number of the white working class people who I surveyed and interviewed over the course of the last few years, that group is a group that may not have liked Hillary that much, may not have necessarily agreed with Donald Trump's policy perspectives, but supported him because he symbolized a middle finger up to Washington establishment. And it is that kind of protest vote that attracted white working class people who for decades have felt left behind. What has troubled so many people about the Donald Trump campaign and persona is that he has largely unabashedly flirted and courted support from racist and white supremacist groups, as opposed to the dog whistle politics and culture wars that previously characterized earlier Republican campaigns. That kind of subtlety was no longer present. And instead, it was a much more overt appeal to the worst instincts among a lot of Americans. When the most powerful person in the world is condoning or, and as I said, flirting and courting the support of these types of groups of people, it is an endorsement implicitly in some of their worldviews. And so unless he makes it explicitly clear and takes action to demonstrate his opposition to white supremacists, then there's always going to be an association and a fear, frankly, that he is actually not only condoning but making it okay to return those kinds of viewpoints to casual conversations, to daily interactions.
That's Dr. Justin Guest, professor of public policy at George Mason University and author of the book The New Minority: White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. Thanks for being with us.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A Tanzanian tribe turns to carbon offsets to protect ancestral forests. Mexico's president plans to show pragmatism in dealing with Trump. Scientists say they found a tiny bit of dinosaur brain. And despite the Trump election, the State Department says it's staying the course on climate and trade pacts. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. This is International Edition. Last week, Arkansas became one of 28 U.S. states to legalize the medical use of marijuana. Another 8 states have passed laws allowing its recreational use. But even as more states allow the use of cannabis, implementing laws regulating pot is proving difficult. And then there's the fact that it is still illegal to possess or grow pot under federal U.S. law. VOA's Kevin Enochs reports.
In Arkansas, voters were clear they think marijuana can have a positive medical impact. But now the state must quickly figure out how to sell and regulate the drug that was illegal just a week ago.
There are a lot of rules and regs and a lot of questions that we're getting right now. Do people get preference? How do employers deal with these questions? How do state employees apply? There's a lot of questions out there that we're getting that we're going to have to work through the answers to.
Medical marijuana is currently being used primarily as a way to combat chronic pain caused by medical illnesses like glaucoma and Crohn's disease, as well as the nausea associated with chemotherapy, HIV. But even as state laws continue to loosen, the federal government says it's still illegal to sell, grow, or smoke marijuana.
The Obama administration gave almost a waiver for the states that are implementing these type of initiatives so that they don't fear federal enforcement powers because it still violates federal law. Will the Trump administration have a different approach? We don't have the new attorney general yet. What will be their approach?
Let compassion begin and inclusive.
Meanwhile, in states like Texas, where pot is still illegal, advocates are already asking legislators to take a second look. Particularly veterans who say that cannabis can ease the symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome. While plenty of questions have to be answered, it is clear that in the states where marijuana is legal, it's meant big bucks for some economies, so it's likely more states will be willing to consider legalization in the future. Kevin Enochs, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Let's lighten things up a bit with a look at what's trending on social media with G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hey, Lori.
So what have you got for us today?
Tuesday was a pretty good day for plus-size women, or really anyone who support diversity in that area. Ashley Graham is one of the most famous plus-size models in America, and now there is a Barbie doll that looks just like her.
Wow.
Graham and the brand Barbie both tweeted about the new doll, and apparently she requested that the Barbie doll's thighs touch. That's
really
a big deal, right? Because hashtag thigh gap was a trending hashtag, I think, a couple years ago. So this is what she tweeted. Thighs touching, round hips, arms, and tummy. Thank you at Mattel and at Barbie for immortalizing me into plastic. Hashtag beauty beyond size. Her handle is at the Ashley Graham.
Wow, that's cool. So what's the online reaction to this?
Lori, the dominant sentiment is that many women are happy there is a version of Barbie that shows plus-size models are beautiful. In many parts of the world, the plastic doll is considered to be the gold standard for conventional beauty with long blonde hair, skinny legs, big busts, and pearly whites. And some people are also tweeting to petition for the Ashley Graham Barbie to become available for purchase because there are only two Ashley Graham Barbies at the moment. But there are people who are unhappy with the plus-size model trend. One mother tweeted, "The new doll should be named a cardiovascular disease Barbie and that her daughter will not be playing with it."
Aww.
That wasn't very nice, but
no.
I see the concern for maybe bigger obesity.
No, I know, but, you know, we should try to be...
embrace diversity.
And just be kind and not make people feel bad. Sometimes people
Absolutely.
Can't, no matter how hard they try, they're just built differently.
Mm-hmm.
So what else is trending?
There's a lively discussion about ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. The country's court overturned his death sentence, which will lead to Morsi and five other Muslim Brother leaders' retrial for their role in a 2011 mass prison break. At least on social media, many Twitter users writing in Arabic appear to be in favor of the overturn. Lori, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA underscore IE. Renowned filmmaker Ava DuVernay of the movie Selma has just released a new documentary called 13th on Netflix that chronicles the history of racial inequality in the United States. Specifically, it examines how our country has produced the highest rate of incarceration in the world, with a majority of those in prison being African-American. One of the film's subjects, Craig DeRoche, who is now Senior Vice President of Advocacy and Public Policy at Prison Fellowship, joins me now to talk more about this important film, 13, which does, of course, Craig, refer to the 13th Amendment of the Constitution in the United States, which reads, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States." Craig, tell us more about the film.
She creatively and artistically wanted to bring the audience in to explain to them that the criminal justice system, the problems that we're facing today, aren't things that were just created in the last 30 or 40 years with a policy or two. They have a very long history in America, and that's why I believe she made the choice to call it 13th. Because of the 13th Amendment.
You are one of the subjects, as we just talked about. How did you become involved in this whole issue?
Well, I, just like the founder of Prison Fellowship, who helped start the war on drugs, who helped start Tough on Crime when he was special assistant to President Nixon, Chuck Colson went to prison for several months, federal prison, for his role in a Watergate-related investigation. And his eyes were open to all of the failings, what was wrong with the criminal justice system in America. He founded Prison Fellowship and spent the rest of his life trying to change the system that he helped push in a direction. Me, myself, I was arrested twice in 2010. I lived a life in addiction to alcohol, 29 years, and I was arrested after I served as Speaker of the House as a conservative Republican in Michigan. And Chuck said that he thought that my experience in both running a government as well as in addiction and having to overcome that and going through the criminal justice system could be used to help other people. And so that's what I've tried to do, and the same as he tried to do. And we were very humbled and honored that Ava DuVernay and others involved with the film thought that I could contribute to it.
Tell us a little bit about what people will see when they watch it.
Well, this is a film that's disturbing. For me, it was very emotionally convicting. And I think that that's what Ava DuVernay wanted to do, that one of the things that has been left behind in the public policy debate in America about criminal justice is we're talking about human beings, the value and worth of a human being. That's the most disturbing part of the film, is to see how evident it is that we've diminished people's value and worth in our criminal justice system.
Why does the U.S. have the largest prison population in the world?
That is the creation of public policy that we could incarcerate our way out of, punish our way out of the problems that we face. And the truth is, we've never been able to do that. As a parent, I've never been able to do that successfully with my kids. Teachers can't do that in the classroom. We need a different approach to criminal justice, but we've tried this top down out of Washington, D.C., tougher sentences, longer sentences, more incarceration for longer periods of time, hoping that what failed at a lower amount will succeed at a higher amount. And it's only exacerbated the problem. And so I would call it graceful and you know, to the side that advanced this, to say that they were trying an experiment they thought would work. It hasn't worked. It's failed. It's made us less safe. And it's destroyed a lot of lives and families over the past 40 years.
Talk a little bit about the disproportionate number of African Americans incarcerated in the United States.
This is an incredibly complicated topic, and it's one that I, as a conservative Republican, I'm so grateful that we're now finally having a national discussion, because the numbers are the numbers. We disproportionately arrest, convict, and incarcerate people of color in America. There are a number of reasons why that occurs, though. And I'm from Detroit. I'm a suburban. When I was in the legislature and serving as Speaker of the House in Michigan, I was in the suburban ring, bordering actually 8 Mile west of Detroit. And I would see the same behavior with African-American mayor, prosecutor, and police chief in Detroit that we criticize when we see it with Caucasian leadership arresting people of color. So it is deeper than just a racist, but racism is a part of it. Funding, perverse incentives to arrest and convict people, moral hazards that we have in place that are unchecked with our prosecutors. It's a complex issue, but this film powerfully helps awaken people to what is actually occurring, where the numbers, as I say, don't lie in America.
And the issue of racism seems to be front and center now following the presidential election. Are you concerned about what you're seeing?
I'm very concerned. My prayer is, and my hope is, that racism is something that we can move past in this country. But it's something that people turn to when they feel disenfranchised.
Well, that's going to do it for our show today, but you can find us anytime online at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. And by the way, if you want to join the conversation, you can tag hashtag 13th with your thoughts on that Netflix movie. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Last month, two newly elected pro-independence lawmakers in Hong Kong, Sixtus Leung and Yao Wai-ching, changed the language of their oaths of office. The Legislative Council barred them from assuming their seats. Hong Kong's judiciary took up the matter to decide whether the two would be able to retake their oaths and assume their office. Before the Hong Kong court handed down a decision, China's top legislative body issued an interpretation of the basic law that in practical terms said no second chance would be allowed. The matter is still with the Hong Kong judiciary. China resumed the exercise of sovereignty over Hong Kong in 1997 under the One Country, Two Systems framework enshrined in the basic law, which vests in Hong Kong executive, legislative, and independent judicial power, and also protects the rights and freedoms of the residents of Hong Kong, including freedom of speech and association. Regarding the recent developments relating to Hong Kong's Legislative Council, Deputy State Department spokesperson Mark Toner said the United States is disappointed.
The United States strongly supports and values Hong Kong's Legislative Council and independent judiciary, two institutions that play a critically important role in promoting and protecting the special administrative region's high degree of autonomy under the basic law and the One Country, Two Systems framework that have been in place since 1997.
We urge the Chinese and Hong Kong Special Administrative Region governments and all elected politicians in Hong Kong to refrain from any actions that fuel concerns or undermine confidence in the One Country, Two Systems principle, said Mr. Toner. Hong Kong's prosperity and stability depend on the successful implementation as provided for by the Joint Declaration and Basic Law, We believe that an open society with the highest possible degree of autonomy and governance by the rule of law is essential for Hong Kong's continued stability and prosperity as a special administrative region of the People's Republic of China.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4.